You're listening to the EdUp Experience, where we make education your business. On this episode of the EdUp Experience, we welcome Dr. Philly Montella, president of Grand Valley State University. Philly is the first woman president in the history of Grand Valley State University, and she is one of higher education's leading entrepreneurs. She's a recognized leader in strategic planning, market expansion, and innovation in the way higher education is delivered. Her innovative drive comes from more than 30 years in educational administration, and she's done path-breaking work while serving as an officer at public and private universities throughout the country. Now, let's get to it.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Joe Salustio.
This is Elizabeth Leiba.
And on the line, we have Philly Montella, president at Grand Valley State University. Philly, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're really excited to have you. Your role as president of an institution today is one of the most important roles that there is, right, considering the impact that your decision-making has on students at this point. But before we get into the nitty-gritty and talk about that kind of stuff, you know, we'd really love to know a little bit about your personal story, how you ascended to the role of president at Grand Valley State University. How are you? How's your health? How's your friends? How's your family during this tough time that we're going through right now?
Oh, thanks for that question, particularly the personal dimension of it. It's an interesting first year as a president, isn't it? It's been kind of a whirlwind ride. I'll start with the latter. My health is great, and my family, I have three grown sons, two are married, and one is soon to be married, and they're all doing well. Their families are doing well. We're in Boston, New York, and Michigan, so you do worry about them every day, for sure.
And before we got started, to interrupt you, you're going to be a grandmother, is that correct?
Yeah,
or maybe you already are.
I am. I'm a grandmother four times, and so this will be number five. I have.
Congratulations. Congrats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's exciting. I'm a very young grandmother, in case you want to know.
Yeah. That's awesome. We'll make sure to highlight that in the show notes. So
yes, please do.
Absolutely.
So, how I started my career, I was a woman of the late 70s. I went to school, and I didn't consider a wide range of careers. I really, you went to your guidance counselor and they said, oh, you're college bound, you're a woman, are you thinking of teaching, social work, or nursing? And, I didn't like blood and I didn't want to be in classrooms, so I picked social work, So that was about how well informed my early college path was. But it turned out to be a great opportunity for me, because one of the things about that particular field is it does both help individuals, and it's got a frame on community and society, and it's really a systems thinking approach. And so it really worked well for me. And through that journey, which, experiential learning and finding out what populations I enjoyed and where I wanted to be, I found college students and vulnerable college populations as where my career started. And I'm not going to take you through, 30 years of higher education. I'll just say that I started on the service side, working in enrollment, financial aid, student affairs, and then broadened into academic innovation and adult and continuing education, digital education at the end of my career at Northeastern University before I joined Grand Valley. And I think that last journey, first I really value my experience, because I got to walk around all aspects of higher ed, including at the end where I oversaw college and at Northeastern, the one immediately preceding coming to Grand Valley, and moved into the academic innovation space. And it really helped me to understand what a presidency was going to be like when you have the whole institutional responsibility And I became very clear about the type of institution I wanted to be at. And I didn't put myself out there in a lot of searches. I felt really fortunate to be leading at Northeastern University what was and remains an institutional identity and inside of the larger institution. It's sort of a separate IPEDS ID, like Penn State World Campus, and had a lot of freedom and a lot of opportunity to experiment. And as you now know, knowing where my family reside was very close to the children, and things were going swimmingly well. And then Grand Valley reached out through the search process. And when I came to find the university and know it, you know, I really, it was everything that I had hoped for. And I knew that I had to be extremely passionate about the place that I would lead. The president's life is absolutely 24/7. And I knew that I had to live and breathe and wanted to live and breathe the work of an institution I truly believed in. And so that brought me here. And I'm happy to share more about, you know, the why of Grand Valley, but I'll pause there in order for us to make it more of a discussion.
Well, and Liz is going to jump in a second, but I did want to recognize that you come, or at least you did your undergraduate and I think your graduate work at a very well-known basketball college that I personally love called Syracuse University.
yeah.
I grew up in Liverpool, New York, which is right outside the sort of the suburb of Syracuse. So I'm a lifelong fanatic of Syracuse. And then it looks like you got your PhD at a lesser basketball school, Michigan State, but I think that's arguable depending on who you're talking to.
There you go.
Here's where I want to start the discussion. And this isn't a typical question for a president. When we have a president on here, I think, you know, we have the tell us about your decision making, and I'll get to that at some point. But you're really active on social media, particularly on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. You're either writing articles, you're sharing information about Grand Valley State University. Tell me why. Tell me why you're active. Is it something you feel the responsibility as a president? Is it a personal thing that you're doing to stay active? Tell me how you use that activity to either your college or talk about the great things you're doing in the community. So give us an overview of why you believe it's important to be active in communicating social media wise.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think if you look at my trajectory, I'm a lot more active in this role than I've been in my previous institutions. And so I think the biggest part of the why for me, and it is a part of what drew me to Grand Valley State University, is I started to look at the landscape of higher education very differently coming out of the innovation space, and started to really think about the kinds of institutions that had the capacity to excel, and what are the kinds of things that we need, what is the frame that we need to hold in order to move education forward. And part of that is, so I came to an institution that is a regional institution. It is, public institution in Michigan, and Michigan's structure is independent in terms of the way in which it's organized vis-a-vis its boards and governance. So we have a lot of capability to be unique, to be different, to make different choices across what many people will see as a state system in other places. And so I found an institution that I believe has the values and is very aligned with what I believe higher education needs to do looking forward. And I'm often asked, and I'm sure we'll get into COVID-19, you know, how has that changed, that vision changed? And I tend to answer that the vision's the same, the pace is accelerated, and the stakes are higher. Because I do believe that the things that I saw that drew me here and the reasons I write about it are what we need even more. So let me say a few things about what they are. One is, this is an institution, it's only 60 years old. Its tuition price point is about $13,000. It runs and delivers education with a deeply interactive faculty model, holistic faculty support for the students. It has, if you're ever on our campus and you walk the campus, you'd see it. It's very focused on the quality and detail and care and concern, and that is whether it's people or facilities. It is, the city of Grand Rapids is one of the, I think it's the second most philanthropic city in the U.S., and that philanthropy is extended to the university. So there's this really strong commitment as a public-private partnership for education. And so it's not someone else's responsibility, federal government to fund, people to pay their own tuition, the state to fund. It is truly an institution that is sponsored in many ways by many of those, many and all of those stakeholders. And it's a very change-able place. And so I believe that higher education many times competes at its detriment, to its own detriment. And so we do not, you know, we sort of hold close our cards because demographics are going down and, you know, pressures, financial pressures are up and we have to compete. And the public is the big loser in this, because if you look at education and the needs for new competencies and the needs for adults to be engaged and who we're leaving behind, there is plenty of room for everyone. It's just that we're all in this very narrow space. And Grand Valley has a very a broader sort of frame on education and who's ready for college and how deep you go into K-12 in order to scaffold folks into college. And so I'm doing a lot of writing on the mindset that says, yes, of course we're competitors. And I'm a fierce competitor, you know, for my own. I love to compete. I love Jim Boeheim and basketball at Syracuse, you know. I mean, so I get that. But we can't compete at the public's detriment to keep narrowing our scopes, to elevate our institutions. So as you've seen, because you obviously have read some of what I've written, it's really about, you know, the equity in education. It's about seeing the opportunity in this very difficult moment to move the things we need to move. And I think there's room for many institutions to take that kind of broader frame and begin to work in new ways across higher education. That's what really excites me.
Well, thank you for that. And I know Liz is chomping at the bit right now because you just set off a bunch of buzzwords. So I'm going to pass it over to her.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to jump on some of your buzzwords because it was fascinating that when I was reading over your background and your experience in higher education, that you come from the enrollment management side and you talked about your administrative roles and how you kind of had a little bit of a varied path, which is really interesting. And how Joe talks about this sometimes in terms of the role of the college president changing and evolving, and how it used to be that they were more of a fundraiser and now they have to kind of look at the strategy. You know, you alluded to it before about the shrinking demographic and how we're all kind of in the same space competing, and obviously we want to always be mindful about the student at the core of our strategic planning. But how do you feel that your background in enrollment management makes you stronger as a president or allows you to strategize in a different way? Yeah. And what would you advise those that maybe don't have that background? What can they do to be a little bit more visionary as we go into not just the shrinking demographic of the college student, but also the COVID-19 crisis and the change in terms of enrollment due to that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the benefits of the background is it starts with the market, right? And I believe education has to take what I call an outside-in look versus an inside-out look. So we have things we offer and we want to push them out to the universe or to the public. You know, the question is, what do people need? How do they learn? I think true enrollment management is really about understanding the learner and understanding the markets. That's how you do it well. It's not by, you know, what are the set of gimmicks that one can do or who can do more visiting and how many have more giveaways. It's really about those two fundamentals. And then being honest with yourself as an institution about what we do well and what we don't do well and how to align those interests or change the way we do our work in order to work to what is important for learners. And so I found it a really helpful background because it does lay a foundation for strategy, without a doubt. It's, you know, as I said, it's about markets, it's about learners, it's about how you make choices around those things and optimize for your institution and for the students. It's about having a graduation mindset, not an enrollment mindset. So those kinds of values were really important. And I think, you know, and you're right, you know, there was a period of time, a very long period of time. It's still, I think, the predominant mode that presidents come out of more traditional academic, you know, faculty to department chair to deans to provost to presidencies. But I think the one second to that was advancement for a very long time and finance. And you would hardly ever see someone out of an area like enrollment or student affairs.
Right.
But enrollment is a really interesting preparation. And in some ways, it is job one now, you know, for presidents. It's where the bulk sustainability, right?
Exactly.
So there's been, I think, a benefit for that. I also think having the perspective to have played many roles so that you can ask the next set of questions. We can challenge one another. Has been useful to me. And then learning how to become an entrepreneur. I think I've always been drawn to creativity. I've been a creative person, but I didn't know the first thing about being an entrepreneur, how to do a lean startup, you know, versus a budget proposal, you know. So I felt like my background was like such a good preparation for what I'm dealing with in this first year. For others, because your question had two sides, I mean, I would, just as I spend time in really trying to understand the faculty culture, the life of a faculty member, the challenges of preparing a course today for online, hybrid, and face-to-face all at the same time, because I haven't lived that life, you know, other than teaching the occasional course. So I think for those who are trained in a different way, take the 360-degree view. Try to really understand the experiences of our colleagues so that you can be a better, stronger leader.
Absolutely. That's really good advice. And I have a little bit of a selfish follow-up question because I saw that you are the first female president of your institution, and I thought that was super awesome. And I think that another... I guess question for me being obviously working in higher education and looking at the demographics of the students and then looking at the leadership and looking at just how women are able to maybe definitely dominate in terms of faculty roles, but sometimes are not able to go beyond that and we don't see as many presidents. What advice would you give women that are working in higher education that want to aspire to leadership roles and I'm not sure exactly how to navigate that. Do you need a mentor? Should you be taking certain classes? Like, what should you do in order to prepare yourself to get where you are today?
Yeah, I think that the first thing I would offer is to find the very best thought partners that you can and have them be people that don't think like you and that press you and that challenge you. And that has been so valuable to me throughout my life. And I always have a list of, you know, a half a dozen people that when I call them on the phone, they will, you know, call bull and really press me on, you know, what it is I'm thinking and how I'm thinking about it. And I'm not sure that that's a gender specific answer, but I do think that, you know, sometimes women want to feel very buttoned up, you know, in terms of like, I've got things in hand, I'm organized, I am as competent as the men that are around this table. And so we tend to be reluctant, particularly I think in these higher level positions, to be more vulnerable. I know it was for
me. And ask questions, right? It's like, we don't want to ask questions. We don't want to look like we don't know what's going on. We don't want to ask questions.
Exactly. So, I mean, that was the most important element of my leadership journey was just having smart men and women around me who would help me really reflect on my own journey and push me on my own thinking.
You're listening to the EdUp Experience, where we make education your business. Hey guys, this is Joe, and I just want to remind you to check out our website at www.edupexperience.com. On the website, you're going to find all of our past episodes that we've done with some of the top leaders in higher education today, talking about innovations, ideas, and issues facing our industry today, finding out what may happen in the future, what higher ed needs to look like moving forward. So again, check out www.edupexperience.com. Now, let's get back to the action.
Awesome advice. Thank you.
Well, we're jumping around a little bit, but that's what makes this fun. And, I think this is an industry with higher ed. It's been dominated by men, and women are an absolute force, at every level. And so I applaud for your ascension into the role. But I do want to get a little bit more nitty gritty and go back to one of the points that you made. You were talking about a philanthropy in Grand Rapids being the second most philanthropic city. And I don't want to get that wrong. But this is more of a question for me versus some statistic I saw. But, you know, fundraising in general is hard for higher ed. You know, when you look at the statistics nationally, I think the majority of dollars, philanthropic dollars, go to like religious organizations, and then higher ed sort of has a small piece of the pie. And then it's divided up, and there's elite institutions that get a lot of money, and then smaller institutions with less. So how do you feel fundraising has been changed or will be changed? I mean, so for the common person, like, I was talking to my family about this while we were sitting around doing nothing except in quarantine. They said, well, who's going to give money to higher education now when they're going to give it to healthcare? And is that a concern for presidents today that, wait a second, the pipeline may be drying up a little bit here on the fundraising side?
Well, I mean, I think fundraising has to be a concern for a variety of reasons. You know, how does this whole experience of COVID-19 make us as individuals assess where the greatest needs are? It might be healthcare. It might be the digital divide. I mean, it's what has happened in K-12 and the ability for people to connect. You know, I'm not talking about the teaching or the support of the school, but just the digital divide that exists has been personified. Is that going to be the recipient of more of the philanthropic dollars? Are the investments and the way they have crashed in the market, and are people just going to preserve their own wealth for a period of time as their returns recover? So I think there's a lot of questions on philanthropy ahead, but I think that where people put their dollars crosses industry and is more about if they believe that where they give will make the impact that they want to make. And so I think that if an institution is truly caring for the large issues, if the large issues in COVID-19 or in the recovery of higher education, or in my case, the economic recovery of the state, which is also a concern as a public university, we are coming up with good ideas, we're coming up with good solutions, if we're finding ways to have multiple contributors, I think the resources will come. But without a doubt, the resources are tighter, and there are many, many, many more people in need.
Well, good thing you have a background in enrollment management then, because that certainly will help. So talk to me about that. I think that's a good point. I mean, you get to the point in doing these podcasts where we interview people sometimes two or three a week, and we're asking, okay, tell me how your decision-making has changed during COVID-19. And, you know, I don't want our listeners to get the same answer. So maybe it's an open question to you. What's been significant for you? Maybe that's a better way to ask it, because there's any area you want to touch on. How has COVID-19 been significant to you as a leader, and what have you had to do to adapt?
Well, you know, maybe I will answer it a little differently. I don't know. I mean, I came into an institution with a certain culture, And I've told you the wonders of Grand Valley State, and I believe in them. It drew me out of my life at an unexpected time. So I really believe in the institution. And the culture is a very positive culture. But the culture of leadership was a much more siloed culture of leadership. People were really delegated responsibility and went in their zone and their area. And I came in, and I'll describe myself as much more of a network leader, you know, where I like to follow where the energy is. And I don't see leadership as one that sort of has to organize and lead people down the prescribed path. I think my job is to unleash energy and to really try to discern whether that energy, that idea, that experiment, that program has the potential to make a meaningful difference, and then bring people around that idea to make it richer and to challenge it, and then decide how not to do it. You know, higher education is it's not a ready, fire, aim. It's reverse. It's an aim, fire, ready. It's, you know, we have a concept. It's a program concept. We believe it's going to be good in the market. We hire tenure track faculty, and because we're sure of that, then we go into the market with it. We find it's right or it's wrong. And then we, you know, we're stuck in terms of the outcomes, in terms of where we're at. And so trying to build things in a way that's light and that allows you to shift if your original research, no matter how good, was wrong. And so that's what really excites me. So I think about, you know, leaders, certainly you can't have chaos. So we have to figure out how to sort of organize that energy, discern the best of it, advance it, move it forward. So COVID-19, so back to your question. So COVID-19, if you have a culture that, you know, is somewhat siloed in the way we lead and manage, you can't have that. So I came from a very different culture with a very different set of leadership principles. I'm sure I was shocking the system. I was creating acceleration teams, and people were scratching their heads, you know, why is the president, you know, tapping a variety of people to work on a certain initiative? And, you know, we were having conversations about what was a cultural difference and how do we move forward, and, you know, why do we think differently about how we lead, and how do we use the best of our difference? And all of a sudden, we're in a situation where it requires, I don't care if your leadership team is 8 people or 10 people or 12 people, and they're the best people in the whole world, they can't lead through this crisis alone. We have to deploy, we have to activate, we have to rely on people across the institution, particularly if we're going to lead from a perspective to try to be as clear, you know, as value-driven and as decisive as we can be quickly, because in any crisis, you have to work at pace. And so you have to have a more networked culture. So for me, what COVID-19 did is it automatically sort of showed the values and the challenges of a more distributed networked environment that has to be organized for decision-making, but gives a lot of prerogatives out in a lot of variety and different areas. So I don't know if that's like everybody else that answered you or if it's different, but
definitely different. So just to, I guess, kind of piggyback on that, because you talked about the decision-making process and programs that make a difference and kind of a strategic mind frame in terms of deciding what programs are going to work, what are not going to work, and how to make those judgment calls. I saw that you have a couple of interesting initiatives and programs, like the bachelor's degree with online with a certificate attached to it, and some experiential learning, student employment initiatives. Talk to us a little bit about just the decision-making process in terms of how you decide how to what kinds of programs to roll out to your students, and how that maybe has changed as we think about return on investment for students, workplace readiness. What are some of the factors that weigh into you kind of rolling out these programs that when I look at them, I'm like, wow, that's really creative. That's out of the box. That's different from what we see at some of the other schools, especially state schools that tend to be a little bit more traditional as far as their program offerings.
Right. So, I mean, let me use the two examples, if I may, to maybe answer the question. So, in coming into Grand Valley, I knew the institution did incredible work educationally, but largely was with a 18 to 22 year old sort of first time, full time freshman student population, which is obviously a declining demographic. And education needs to be delivered much more over a lifetime. So the work they were doing there is great. It's wonderful. It continues. I love it. But we needed to look at the adult, some college space, because we didn't want to, again, looking from a systems thinking, we didn't want to jump in to areas where community colleges were doing great work, fine work. We were looking at the numbers of individuals that were in the some college adult learner space in Michigan, started to map that to the public policy issues in Michigan, where the governor was articulating that, and I won't get the numbers exactly right, but they're close, that, Michigan had, I think, a 38% bachelor's degree completion rate for adults. The average in the U.S. was 45%, and her goal was 60%. Always remember my theory, you start outside in. So the first things we did is a market study to look at, what is in most demand? Well, who are employers? What do they need? What should these completions be in? Because you can easily go to what can I easily put in the market, but you start from the other direction. What should these be in order to give adults a leg up and to offer things where we know the employability is high, particularly because adults are many times, linked to families and communities and stay in the region. So we started there. We took an analysis. I began to work with the governor and start to look at her goal and what level of degree completion the public institutions were completing. And we weren't going to get to her goal in her time frame. It was impossible unless institutions began to step into the market with things that were scalable and different and accelerated and really responded to how adults learn. And so we mapped back, then you map back into the institution. And what did I find? I found we had an accelerated interdisciplinary degree that was delivered by a wonderful group of faculty and a very cohort-based model that was pretty constrained in size and started to say, well, can we approach this differently? Can we take that and morph it a bit into a more scalable model? Can we use the skills and talents, all the things you iterated on, experiential learning, the success coaching, all of them were in this program. Can we do it on a larger level? Where there was an emphasis in the program, can we make that a certificate that is aligned with the professional skills gap? And all of a sudden we had something. Again, I could go into the teams we deployed and how we thought about it. So it was starting from the outside and then looking inside on where do I have the talent and assets to build from? And then being really conscious of not just building in spaces where we were creating redundancy. Just a quick moment on the SE Plus, which was our most recent announcement, which is Student Employment Plus. We all know that one of the things that students are going to be challenged with is internships and co-ops and experiential learning. Well, Grand Valley, because of the kind of students we have and because of how lean we are as an institution, has student employees everywhere. And it actually is what makes it a very student-centered culture, because I've worked at institutions that are R1s and where, only a subset of the faculty and staff are really working with students. And so at Grand Valley, everybody touches students. I have 12 students that work in the president's office. Everybody has student employees. So it's part of what keeps the culture really to resonate with what's going on with students that I love. But anyways, we started to say, what if we take the student employment and we build the best of experiential learning in it, which is challenging supervisors not to put students where it's convenient, like at the president's front desk, but instead to say, why can't they be ambassadors for check-ins from the president? Why can't they do, you know, a million interesting things because our students are brilliant, you know? So enrich the jobs, create a framework so they become experiential learning, reflections and ways that they think about how their skills are translating. Give them an opportunity to apply for credit, pay them at a higher level, and turn much of what we're doing, not all, you can't turn it all, into experiential learning. And so that's the pilot we have going on right now. And that's really, again, working with the problem. What's the problem? What's the asset? And how do you create a map that's really interesting and creative and differentiated?
Super interesting. And I love that perspective of looking at problem solving. I think that probably we can attribute that to your enrollment management background, where it's more of not necessarily looking at, let me just put this program out here for the sake of the program, but how can we be a little bit more strategic and how can we be practical in what we're offering students and make sure it is value added. And that's awesome that you guys are doing that. Kudos for that, yeah. For sure.
Yeah, I thought it was more attributed to the fact that I raised three sons really active and crazy and I had to pride for myself.
That too, for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Philly, we want to be really sensitive to your time. Sounds like you have a lot going on. So I want to leave you with our final two questions, and here we go. So number one would be, is there anything that you would like to leave our audience with regarding Grand Valley State University, anything that you would like our audience to know about what you're doing and the work there? You said a lot, but anything additional? And secondly, what do you think the future of higher education will look like?
I do think I never lose an opportunity to talk about Grand Valley, but I hope I've weaved in why it's such a special place. And I think you'll hear from us more and more. We have a big vision and we want to make a big contribution in higher education. I think I have this heart that I've hand drawn on my whiteboard at the office because I've been going in and out, you know, as one of the essential workers with my mask and social distancing. And it says the best is yet to come. And it just reminds me that as difficult of a period it is, and it has been, it's difficult. And I think the pain ahead is going to be substantial for people and for higher education. And there'll be closures and there'll be consolidations and schools that were on the brink that have liquidity challenges are facing very, very difficult times. But I do think that it's going to press us. If we think, you know, one day we're talking about whether or not it's good to do digital learning and the next day, you know, people, faculty will prefer digital learning because they feel safer and they know it's good quality and they know they can deliver. It's pushing us to the best of digital education. It's hopefully we see how face-to-face is a precious asset that should not be wasted and therefore should not be used in ways that you can, when we see our family now, right, we want to give them a hug and we want to just really know what they're thinking and not just ask how their day was. It's the same thing. And I think this whole issue of equity that has been personified can be addressed with some level of focus on how we get out of the supply chain mentality and into the personalization of education, because everybody is going to need to flex a little differently coming out of this crisis. Some of us have not been impacted personally, others have. Some of us will be caring for people with illness and will need at home. Some are too distracted at home. Some will need to work more. Some can go on with the immersive experience and they can't wait to get out of their parents' basement and into a college and university experience again, you know? So I think that those are the three areas I would focus on. Let's bring the best of digital forward. Let's bring the best of face-to-face forward. And let's try to get out of this supply chain mentality and allow people to flex so more can be included.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on the EdUp Experience. It was a real honor to have you here, particularly as a woman at the highest level in higher education. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to see, and we wish you the best of luck. And I hope we get to have you back on the show in the future, and you're going to tell us about how much Grand Valley has grown since the last time we talked.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the well wishes and the affirmation. So thank you very much. And you both were a joy to talk with.
All right. Well, you stay safe out there and pass on our best to your students and staff.
Okay. Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Philly Mantella, president of Grand Valley State, on our show to talk about her leadership during this crisis and the growth that she's seeing. Liz, powerful, knowledgeable, motivated, competitive woman on the show at the presidential level. It was refreshing and awesome to have her here. What did you think about the conversation?
That's exactly what I was going to say. I was really inspired by her as a woman leader, and not just a leader, at the highest level. I mean, that's like an awesome thing. And in higher education, we think about it and we talk about it, the diversity and making sure that we have representation. And it was interesting to see that she comes from such a different background. She's been in enrollment management, and she alluded to that idea that sometimes that's not necessarily the traditional path. And it was interesting to see just how her decision-making process and her strategic outlook as far as what's good for students and what to roll out and how to execute was informed by her background. So I liked the conversation. I really enjoyed listening to just her thought process, and she gave some good advice, you know, for women that are aspiring and want to grow and want to go up the chain and aspire to leadership positions. What are some of the things and some of the strategies that you can pursue? So great conversation. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, you know, I think that was the best part about it, is, you know, bringing that perspective on. But, you know, as you get to the nitty-gritty of her background, I think, you know, she represents what, in my opinion, and this is my humble opinion, the university president, you know, of the future, somebody that has deep enrollment marketing experience. She talks about outside in, you know, before you create a program, are you looking at Google search results? Do you know that your program can be found in the first place before you even spend time creating it? I mean, there's these basics that marketing basics, it sounds like she has down. And then she's doing what you would need to do, which is spending a great deal of time understanding faculty and their perspective, because without that, you can't train students the way you want to. But it's really refreshing, at least for me, to see that person coming from outside of enrollment management, student services, ascending to that level, a lot different than we've had on the show before for people that, you know, presidential, I don't say candidates, but people who've been at the presidential level background. So a different take, I'd say, a refreshing take.
Absolutely. Agreed. 100%.
Well, this was another great episode, Liz. Appreciate it as usual. And, just a reminder to everyone to check out our website for this and previous episodes. And until next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the EdUp Experience. You can visit us at www.edupexperience.com for previous episode, links to our social media, and more. Please feel free to rate, review, subscribe, and share this podcast. You've been listening to the EdUp Experience with your hosts, Dr. Joe Salustio and Elizabeth Leiba.